it becomes very significant to decide how all this started. It's not an academic sort of question. How it began decides the question of how we ought to deal with it, who we are, where we're proceeding. For some people, I'm sure, as is characteristic of a lot of scientists, it's all very academic. It's their field. And so they study the matter of beginnings. And they don't mind toying with a lot of novel notions. They're not committed to anything in particular, and when the whole matter is put aside, they haven't really lost anything that was important to them. But for us, it is important. It's not a question of scientific interest. It's a question of ultimate spiritual interest. So tonight, we want to talk about the beginning for a very short time. And a good place to begin studying the beginning is the most important beginning of all. You know how Genesis starts? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Was there ever a more succinct and easily stated description of how all reality came into existence? There are a lot of problems with talking about the beginning, though. I mean the real beginning. Because the best evidence for happenings in history is eyewitness testimony. And the problem we have with this particular beginning is we don't have any eyewitnesses of the human variety. I was not there. However, some young people might feel. And so I cannot testify. And I don't know anybody else who was there who could say, I saw it. By very virtue of the fact that it is the beginning of everything, there was no one there to record the events out of those whose origins began here in Genesis, or in the time that Genesis 1:1 describes. So, we have to depend on the testimony of God in this case, because He was the only one who was there. For either He was there and can testify to what occurred, or there wasn't anyone or anybody there who could testify, who would have cared, because there was no personality, there was no mind, there was no purpose, there was no intention. Job asked the question in Job 38:4, or God asked the question of Job in Job 38:4, and it's a very sobering kind of question. And the question is, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? And Job would have to answer just like the rest of us have to answer, I wasn't there. And I'm in no position to say how the thing started. And more than that, as he learned from further inquiries that God made of him, he wasn't in a position to say how it ought to continue and to make any judgments about that. Scientists talk a lot about how things were in the beginning. And you'd think the way they talk about it, they must have been there, because they describe it in detail. This happened, that happened, and then this happened next. And I'm not trying to speak disparagingly of all science, but when scientists get to dealing with ultimate origins, they're just completely outside their bailiwick. They don't know anything more about that than you and I do. They don't have any instruments to determine that. They can experiment using what's called the scientific method, and some people think that's been overdrawn, but at any rate, they can draw up their experiments and they can determine whether or not a certain thing can happen. But they cannot determine what happened then. There's no way that that matter can be settled. But I tell you, from reading in Job, it must have been a wonderful occasion, something that would have been wonderful to see, Job 38. If you'd share this with me. God is speaking to Job, who's been very short of temper with the Lord, and he has suggested that maybe God just hadn't gotten it right. And this is the first time that the silence of heaven has been broken. All Job's companions have been doing a lot of time talking, spend a lot of time talking, but this is the first time that Job has gotten his request, because he's been saying, come down here and talk to me. This is not fair. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, and he said, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up now your loins like a man, for I will demand of you, and then you will declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare it if you have understanding. Who determined the measures thereof, if you know? Or who stretched the line upon it? Whereupon were the foundations thereof fastened? Or who laid the cornerstone thereof when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? That must have been something to see. Angels might have been present. This expression, sons of God, is sometimes used to describe them. But what a wonder it must have been to see all this thing formed, coming into being, out of nothingness. God speaking, and His words taking concrete shape. That's something that even in my wildest dreams, I can't put any form to. But that's how the Bible says it began. And that's just about as much detail as you've got about it outside the initial first two chapters of Genesis that don't give you much detail anyway. But I tell you, from looking at all the answers to this question that have been given by scientists, I don't have any trouble just accepting what is there and being content with it. Because the answers that scientists give to the question, how did things begin, have changed so much through the years. You'd almost have the feeling that they nailed that question down a long time ago, and that all they've had to do since then is just put the finishing touches on it. But the truth of the matter is that in its very nature, their explanations have changed. In the beginning, God. And when you think about that, it's an exercise in thinking past time into infinity, and that's tough. Brother Ed Harrell recently told a story in my hearing about being on an airplane and picking up a copy of Science Magazine that was there available. He said he didn't want to read Business Week, and he didn't find anything else that was exciting, so he read Science Magazine, and particularly because there was an article right on the front that was advertised before the beginning, A Weird New Cosmology. And it was written by a Cornell astrophysicist, which, you know, should have been something written with some considerable authority. Well, the fellow took up his task, and he was explaining the Big Bang Theory. You know, there are two basic theories, the origin of the world and the scientific community, and that is the steady state theory, which is not exactly in the ascendancy now. It's sort of running down, which means that the world is just sort of pulsated through eternity. It just keeps going like this, and it's maintained a steady state like that. And the other view is the Big Bang Theory, which says that there wasn't anything at one point, and everything was down here in a tiny little ball, and then it exploded. Well, he was trying to run the thing back in time, and he just talked about how it looked 2 seconds before the explosion. Then he got it down to a millisecond before the Big Bang took place. And he said it was just a tiny thing about the size of a golf ball or something like that. And all the matter of the whole universe was right there in that golf ball-sized piece of matter. And he said it was heavy stuff. And I guess it must have been. Heavy. Well, he ran it back as far as he could get it. And he said he's just getting to the good part. And he was getting excited about what he was going to read next. And then he said, and before that, we don't have any idea what happened. He said he felt like suing a fellow for false advertising. He just said he was going to tell the story, and he didn't tell it. Well, you know, sooner or later, you're going to have to get back there, too, to the place where you're going to have to think about something that's infinite. What was before the beginning? Moses in Genesis just says it in a very simple way. He says, in the beginning, God. Have you ever had a little child ask you who made God? Well, they're just wrestling with this question of getting back to something that has always been. I read an account of some lecturer who was speaking on the nature of the universe. And some woman during the question period raised her hand and said she had a better explanation of that than he did. And I think this may have taken place in the British Isles. And he said, what is that? He said, well, I'll tell you. He said, we are not living on a little orb that's circling the sun. He said, that's what we are not doing. He said, what we are doing is we're on a crust of earth that's sitting on the back of a turtle. And he said, yes, but what's that turtle standing on? She said, on a bigger turtle. He was pretty well frustrated, but he said, well, what is that bigger turtle standing on? He said, there's no sense arguing. It's turtles all the way. Well, you know, that's about as good a story as has been concocted by anybody who is unwilling at last to say there is something or someone here who has always been and who in the final analysis is the ground rock of all existence. Just sort of makes sense. Frankly, I don't find that turtle story a bit more silly than some of the stories I read in serious scientific journals about how things happen. And I don't read that too often because I can't understand most of that, but I can understand a little along, and I can get the drift of things, and before I'm through, I can see exactly what's happening here. They just keep running the thing back and running the thing back. But let me say to you that in the beginning, God has a lot to commend it. When, as an option, they talk about evolution. You say, well, evolution is a very, very respected scientific theory. Not in a lot of circles. I just picked up a book by Fred Hoyle and an unpronounceable Indian astrophysicist. I could not even dare try to pronounce his name. But these two men laugh evolution to scorn. And no one has had more impact in the world of astronomy in this century than Fred Hoyle, the British astronomer. And what they said is, and this is a result of figuring out how complex the world is. You know, science, sooner or later, helps itself out. And we've learned in this century about DNA, about these little helical spirals of polypeptides or whatever they put together there. My brother could tell me all that if I'd ask him about it, and then I wouldn't understand it when he told me. But anyway, they're all put together there, and they are very complex. And you've got to have that genetic kind of material to have anything. Nothing works without it. Where do you get all that information? Enormous amounts of information put in those tiny little organic pieces. And what that's done is make us realize that even if we had a universe 50 times this big, and if we had 50 times as much time as the most wide-ranging estimates of the age of the earth, that it wouldn't be enough time to get anything out of random activity. And if I may sum up what these fellows said in their book entitled Evolution from Space, they just said it couldn't happen. There is no way that it could possibly have occurred. The mechanism suggested by evolutionary theory simply unable to accomplish it. You know what their answer is? Somebody says, surely they have had sense enough to say in the beginning, God. Well, no. What they decided was that life came from outer space. That it could not have developed as a consequence of any kind of things happening in our little solar system. That there is no way to have that. So they have said that it was brought in by intelligence from outer space. This intelligence had to come. Well, that's about as bad as turtles. And then where did that intelligence come from? And then when you've got that subtle, where did the intelligence that created that intelligence come from? It just keeps on going back and back and back, and you finally have to face the question, what was there in the beginning? And Hoyle did not face that question, although he is attacking with ferocity his colleagues on the subject of evolution. I think you're going to see evolution put into very great disarray before this century is over. But the thing that science... No, it's not science that's unwilling to face this. It's scientists that are unwilling to face this. The thing that Hoyle said he was being charged with, the thing that his colleagues were very nervous about, was the fact that if he continued this, he was going to drive men back to Genesis 1. And we'd be back to that old archaic notion again. Well, Hoyle is not ready to do that. Because if Genesis 1:1 is true, we've got a lot to think about here. And not scientific theories. Not how the world was put together in terms of its actual makeup, but why it was put together and why we're here and what it's all about. In the beginning, God created. You know, Genesis 1:1 purports to be an eyewitness account, wouldn't you say? An eyewitness account. In the beginning, God created. And there's only one witness that could have reported it. And that was the one who originated all this. Hebrews 11:3 is not outdated. It may be simple, but it's not simplistic. By faith we know that the worlds were framed by the Word of God. That's how we know this. And I can tell you, Fred Hoyle, with all his genius, and all the other astrophysicists of this particular time, do not know what and how the world began. But you and I, we know the answer to that question. And we know it the only way it can be known. By faith. I tell you why I know that. I know that because Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. And he's the one that gave testimony to the fact that he that made them in the beginning made them male and female. And he's the one that put the imprimatur of his own person upon that story in the 19th chapter of Matthew and in the other accounts in the Gospels. And what he said was, that's how it happened. And that's my Father's word about that. And it all hinges on this person, Jesus Christ. But you're going to have to think about that. He's brought the creation of the world down to a very narrow place and a very narrow testing ground there on that hill outside Jerusalem. And the question of whether or not that tomb was empty and why it was empty becomes significant insofar as the origin of all things is concerned. If you have faith in God, you know where the universe came from. And the only way in the world you're going to find out how it began is by faith, because there wasn't anybody else there. And you're just going to have to accept the only testimony that's available, and that's the testimony of the one who did it. And that faces all of us, what we're going to do with it. The heavens and the earth, he created. Well, that's everything. There's not anything left out. And the amazing thing about the universe that God made is its absolute infinite, almost infinite variety. I found out something recently that a computer cannot produce a random sequence. Somebody says, I'm so glad you learned that. I have been wanting to know that for a long time. A computer cannot produce a random sequence. And the reason a computer cannot produce a random sequence is because it is built on the model of the human mind. And the human mind is ordered. And inevitably, when the human mind starts, if you ask a human being to make a random sequence, it will inevitably take on order. But if you look at the universe, you can see all kinds of randomness. Not any two human beings alike. Not any two of us alike. Not any two snowflakes alike. Total random activity. And yet order in the midst of it. We've recently learned in the new physics that really there is not some sort of orderly procedure of the electrons and neutrons and protons in this unseen sub-microscopic world almost, that there is not some sort of order and some sort of rule, but what you have is a lot of random activity that when you add it all up, it turns into order and to rule. But anyway, human beings turn to order and incline to order, but it's wonderful what God has done. Notice some of the things that God talks to Job about here in the book of Job. He talks about hippopotamuses, or hippopotami, if you will, and about the wonder of the wild ass, the wild ox. You can just read through here and see all these particular creatures that God has made. And I tell you something, as much as I am amazed at the thought of man making a vessel that could fly him to the moon, as much as that astonishes me, the thought of it, I tell you what, I believe it's a lot harder to make a hippopotamus than it is to make a space machine. That's what I believe about it. In the final analysis, I'm a lot more in awe of a wild ass than I am some of these big buildings that human beings have put together. As one friend of mine says, I say, those big old buildings, they're pretty impressive, but dump them in the Grand Canyon, see how big they look. You know, see what wonder they evoke from us. So the truth of the matter is, all the things that man have made are not very impressive. But the simplest thing that God has put together in His genius, that is very impressive. And so the challenge that God made to Job was, you know, do you understand all these things? Have you looked at the world that I've made? Have you comprehended at all the genius of it? Have you seen the intricate nature of it? I tell you one thing we're finding out as we get smarter, and that is that we're not so smart as we thought we were. And that the world we live in is immensely complex. And we had no idea. We had these nice little simplistic theories about it all, and we were feeling rather proud of ourselves as we developed them. But things just kept getting out of joint, and something came up that didn't fit our theory, and so we're continually having to change in radical ways our explanation of the nature of the physical world, because it's largely behind us, beyond us. God even talked to Job about an ostrich. Verse 13 of the 39th chapter. The wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are they the pinions and plumage of love? For she leaveth her eggs on the earth, and warmeth them in the dust, and forgetteth that the foot may crush them, or that the wild beast may trample them. She dealeth hardly with her young ones, as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is without fear, because God hath deprived her of wisdom. Why does an ostrich act like an ostrich? Because God made the arrangement. Here's this ostrich that can lay her eggs and put it in the nest and then walk off and forget where they are. Forget where they are. And if she remembers, not even care. As a matter of fact, this description of the behavior of that bird, this ungainly bird that runs so fast can never fly. Why is an ostrich that way? Because that's the way God made the ostrich. Because she's got a brain about the size of a walnut, and she doesn't, if she's got one that big, and she doesn't remember those things. That's the way God made it. A lot of other things in the world. Wonderful things. Surprising. The world is full of all this as a demonstration of the fact that the world in which we live has been created by God. And that's what Genesis says. You can't explain this any other way. You can struggle and try, but there's absolutely no way in the world that all this variety, all this complexity. And in the midst of all that, a running thread of moral concern that is evidenced in every human breast. There is no way to explain this as the product of random activity and mindless forces. Why do we try? Because we're trying to escape from responsibility to a God who created us and has a purpose for us. We all try to tell our story. One anthropologist was talking about a primitive society that had been sheltered from civilization, which sometimes, given the nature of our civilization, doesn't sound like too bad an idea. But anyway, they were sheltered from civilization, and she was talking to them about their explanation of the beginning. And they told her, well, God had in the beginning carved out this very valley. And He had put the people there. In this valley. And that was how it all started. And she said to them, but what about the people on the other side of the mountain? They said, they'll have to make up their own story. And that's exactly what we do. We make up our stories. Now you're going to have to decide which story is going to be yours. Whether it's going to be the one that the Bible tells that is linked to the manifestation of the world of the person of Jesus of Nazareth, who claimed to be the Son of God and who evidenced His claim by doing wonders and signs which are testified to here, and whose wisdom is as clear as the writings of His great teachings on the pages of the Gospels, and who, as a consequence of having been here, motivated men to yield their lives in absolute submission and seal their testimony with their blood, You have to ask yourself whether or not that's going to be the story that's going to be your story, or you want that one about turtles or something equally foolish. Think about yourself now, the kind of being you are. Not just that you have intelligence, but that you have a moral nature, and that you judge your own activity on the basis not of what you can do if you want to, but on the basis of what you ought to want to do and whether you've done what you should do or not. And ask yourself this fundamental question, where did that come from? I tell you, all that we see and observe in the world in which we live, just as God told Job, he ought to look around a while, tells us that in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and the nature of things is such that it was necessary for the God who created the world and had a purpose in his mind when he did so to reveal himself to us and to tell us what that purpose was. That's the one thing we need to know. We're sort of like Manoah, who, when he was told by his wife that the angel had come and told that she was going to bear a child, then Manoah said, tell the angel to come back again and tell us how we ought to raise this child. Here we are in the world that God has made, and we're aware of the fact that the heavens declare His glory, and that we are creatures made by forces that are intelligent and moral, and that there's some purpose here. And now what we've got to find out is, what is the purpose? We need to know our purpose. And what the Bible says is, this is the answer. This is the purpose. God created you to serve Him. The whole duty of man is to fear God and keep His commandments. That's the answer. It's the answer of Ecclesiastes, but that's the answer you get also in the speech that Paul delivered to the people in Athens. He said that God made of one every nation of men and dwell upon the face of the earth for one purpose only, that they might seek after God, if haply they might feel after Him and find Him. And so, having decided first of all and elementally that there's a God who made us, then our next and most important task is to find out about Him so we can know who we are. Somebody says, but that leaves us a lot of things to look at. We've got to look at the Hindus. Well and good. They don't even believe in one God. They got a multiplicity of deities. Pagan polytheism gone to seed. Wild and strange. The world is as it is because that's the way it was supposed to be. No basis for morals. No basis for right and wrong. A monistic system of thought that says that everything that is. And that's the way it's supposed to be. And you ought to yield to that because that's the way it is. There is no moral quality in Hinduism. Somebody said, what about Buddhism, which is an offshoot of Hinduism? Buddhism doesn't even believe in the existence of any personal God at all. Talks about nirvana, the place where you're going to just be absorbed into some sort of world soul, and there'll be no consciousness of anything by anybody. Not even God, as he described it, has any consciousness. There's no moral purpose in that. And just exactly like Hinduism, Buddhism has no base on which to build a moral system. Tradition or something like that is used, but it's a tremendous vacuum there. And what's left to us, somebody says, what about Islam? What about the Muslims? The Muslim theology is built on the Bible, or at least it claims to be. And when you read the Quran, it's evident from the very beginning that you're supposed to already have read the Bible, know all about Moses and know about Jesus. The problem with the Quran is that it tells us that Jesus never claimed to be the Son of God, and we're called upon to believe a witness who lived 500 years after the event rather than the witness who's testified living at the very occasion when these things happened. And it's preposterous. There's no way. What I'm telling you is that the Bible carves a niche in this world that is unique and special, and it's not because you and I had to be born to parents who believed it. It's because that's the way it is. And I'm telling you this evening that if you look at it with careful eyes and serious mind, you'll come away from this book saying, Jesus Christ is Lord, and He's the revelation of the God who created the universe. And we need to listen to Him because it is the voice of God that speaks here. It is the will of God that speaks here, and our destiny is wrapped up in it. And for that very reason, we've got to be serious about this. We get so silly sometimes. We are busy about things that don't matter a hill of beans. Instead of being concerned about this issue, somebody said, don't talk to me about those far-out philosophical questions. Listen to me. This philosophical question is as near as your nose. It's about you and who you are and where you're going, and you've got to deal with this question. When Jesus says to you, except you believe that I am He, you will die in your sins, then everything from Genesis to Revelation is impinging upon you, and you're going to have to deal with it. That empty tomb you're going to have to deal with. The testimony of these men you're going to have to deal with. The question of who you are and how it all began you're going to have to deal with. And you're going to have to deal with it now because this is the only life you've got and you're hurtling forward like a man in a spaceship going somewhere and you've got to get ready to meet the destination. God is out there. And Jesus Christ has spoken His gracious will to us. And it's gracious, isn't it? It's loving, isn't it? It's a message of concern and hope and encouragement that comes to us in the Scripture. And why would we want to turn away from it? Why would we want to find some silly explanation for things? Unless we just wanted to be so foolish that we just stubbornly persist in doing our own thing no matter what God thought. I can't believe anybody in this audience tonight would have that attitude. Can't believe anybody here would not be concerned about his soul, about eternity, and the right relationship with God. And because I feel that way about it, I keep on preaching and imploring and entreating, confident that at some moment, right now, or in the dead of night, or early some morning, someone will say, I'm ready to be a Christian. I want to confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Why not now, my friend? This is a time for you. The God that created all things, He's calling on you to come and be His child through His Son, Jesus Christ, if you will believe and be baptized in Him. You can have that blessed relationship at this very moment, and the future is secure while we stand here and say,